Primetime Sports is brought to you by Bodog.net. Join Bodog today.
To him, titles don't matter. VP, CEO, GM. He's never afraid to call BS. This is Primetime Sports with Bob McCowan on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Damian Cox, who is co-hosting this week, has just confessed to me that his aspiration as a young man was to be a monk and take a vow of silence. And so he is, since that didn't work out, he's decided to take that same vow of silence on this program and therefore is not going to talk at all. Isn't that right, Damian? Yeah. That's good for radio. Why don't you just leave then? I mean, we'll pay you. We'll pay you the exact same. There he goes. Goodbye. Coming up on the program, interesting guests. The great news is I'll be able to talk to these people unencumbered by Damian's stupid questions. Rob Becker will join us later. Greg Zahn will be in studio. Blue Jays GM Alex Anthopoulos explaining the John Farrell situation. Don Banks of Sports Illustrated. And Doug Smith, who spent some time with Steve Nash. He's out in California for the San Francisco-St. Louis Game 7 tonight. But I guess Nash is there. I don't know why Nash would be there. Do the Lakers have their training camp in San Francisco? That wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. San Francisco has their own team. Although they call them the Golden State Warriors, or nonetheless, they're San Francisco's. I don't know. So that's all coming up on the program. Perhaps we'll take some calls. I knew you couldn't shut up for long.
Just fascinated, as always, to be in conversation with you, Robert.
So, you want to throw your two cents in on the, well, we spent the last part of last week telling you it was imminent.
Telling me?
No, telling the...
telling them.
The listener, that it was imminent. Farrell was on his way out of town, and yesterday it happened.
Yeah, it did. You know, and I don't think it has a great impact on the Blue Jays. I think it would have been nice for them had they been able to pick up a player of some significance, which they were not able to. But, you know... This guy's he's not nothing. He's something.
He's something,
I don't think there's any evidence at this point that they're letting the greatest manager of all time go.
No.
Now, he may go on. We know that a lot of coaches, managers in sport fail miserably at their first job and then go on to great success. My best example, I remember Ronnie Lancaster when he first coached Saskatchewan? He's terrible. Joe Torre, his first managing job, didn't do well. You know, there's lots of guys you can go along and find. Maybe John Farrell's that guy. But at this point, you know, there doesn't seem to be either any indication that he is that guy or that he's not eminently replaceable with some other guy of similar qualities that may or may not be able to make this a better baseball team.
Blair made the comment, and I don't know whether I agree with it or not. I haven't thought about it long enough. He made the comment that he wasn't anxious to see Farrell go because the projected list of candidates to replace him are almost exclusively guys who haven't managed themselves. And he saw no upside in replacing a guy who you'd finally gone through the first 2 years learning curve with, and replacing him with a guy who would have to go through that same learning curve.
But that suggests they had a choice.
That's number one. Well,
he told me he wanted to go.
Yeah, but they did have a choice. Well, let me ask you this. The speculation started mid-season, June, July. Farrell has one more year left on his contract.
Correct.
If the Blue Jays management, to wit, Anthopoulos, had decided that John Farrell was a guy he wanted to keep, liked what he'd done, the time to offer him a contract extension was then. To the best of our knowledge, such an offer was never forthcoming. So if you really wanted to keep him, you add a couple more years to his contract. You give him a 2-year contract extension.
If you really wanted to.
If you really wanted to.
Right.
What this says to me is they hadn't decided whether John Farrell was any good or not.
I think they were going to let him play out his contract and then make a decision after the third year. There was no indication, Bob, that they planned to dismiss him despite this horrific season. A season in which his management decisions, attitudes, ideas, the way he ran this ball club, were all under increasing scrutiny as the season wound down. They weren't going to fire him either. And they probably had some reason to fire him.
Yeah. Well,
but I do agree. I think Jeff makes a point that I would agree with, in that the list of candidates, you know, are a lot of these kinds of guys. And I think that the greater concern here than what happened to John Farrell and what happened with John Farrell is that it establishes in some ways, not totally, but in some ways, that Toronto's a place you stop off at en route to something better.
Yeah,
and that's not what used to be the case.
A message that should be concerning. It's concerning to me, and it should be concerning to the fan base. And for that reason, I wonder whether this might not have been an option. And I'll give you the scenario. So sometime in the last week, John Farrell goes to Alex Anthopoulos, as he apparently did, and says, I would like to be the manager of the Boston Red Sox. That's my dream job. Do you think Alex Anthopoulos could have said, I don't care what your dream job is. You are the manager here, and you will be the manager next year unless you quit. And if you quit, you still aren't going to be the manager of the Boston Red Sox because you'll still be under contract to us. So you will have to decide whether you want to stay here and see how things play out. And the alternative is you're going to have to wait another year, at which point the Red Sox will have hired their third manager in 3 years. And what are the chances they're going to get rid of him in order to bring you in?
I guess the question would be then let's say he said, oh, okay. So what kind of a managerial, what kind of a relationship do you have there? What's left? I mean, I think you'd have to really want the guy. Bob.
No, but wait. Think about that. Just think about what you have. What you have is you're telling your existing manager, you can't go to Boston now.
Mm-hmm.
You're the manager here for one more year. That's your contract. At the end of this year, you'll see where you want to be. We'll see where we want to be.
And you're also sending a message to the other teams in baseball saying, don't come and try to pick off our guys.
Especially not with, a mediocre middle infielder as compensation.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, we're going to have Alex Anthopoulos on in a little while. We'll ask him that question. That was certainly one goal. That's a hard-line way to play it.
Well, but I think it says to me, Damon, I think that option existed.
Mm-hmm.
I think they discounted and dismissed that option. I presume they dismissed it because they didn't think Farrell was going to work. They don't think he's going to be good enough.
Well,
otherwise, you say, you got another year. You're here, pal.
Yeah, so you think he's a poison pill. You think they're sending in a guy they didn't want. I don't know.
I think it has to be that way.
I just don't see that Anthopoulos is that devious a guy. In fact, I think it's the opposite.
Well, if he's not, then there's something wrong with him.
No, I think he just thought, look, the guy doesn't want to manage. We're not even sure about him. He wants to go, fine. We'll take a player and we'll go in another direction. In a lot of ways, Bob, I think this buys Alex a little bit more time. Let's face it. He was heading towards an offseason in which he was going to be under extreme scrutiny as to the kinds of improvements he could make to the ball club. Now you can say, look, new manager. Got to give the guy time. New manager, new people, new.
Well, he could say that, but I'm not going to buy that, and neither are you. Well, because ultimately, Alex Anthopoulos made the decision.
He's not selling it to you and I. He's selling it to the fans.
Well, the fans aren't that stupid. They aren't going to buy that. You know, this happened for a reason. Alex Anthopoulos made a conscious decision to allow John Farrell to go. You cannot convince me that somehow he was under extraordinary pressure and he had no other option. And that's been written. And I don't buy it for one second. He had the option. He could have made the choice. Farrell went to him privately. It would never have to have gotten out. And Farrell's the manager. And you say, John, you're the manager. If you say one thing about the Boston job, we'll call you into breach, and that'll be the end of you.
I think you're also assuming that this was Alex's choice.
Ultimately, it was. I think it was 100%.
Well, and Alex's choice. That's the point. You don't think as has been acknowledged and reported, that the contacts were at the higher level between Paul Beeston and John Henry and that level. And you know it's not Beeston style to play hardball either. He would say, I bet you if he was here, the guy doesn't want to work for us, he wants to go work for the Red, let him go. Now, yeah. Whether you could have played it tougher and got more in exchange, that I don't know.
No, I don't know that either.
But to me, that sounds like Beeston to me.
Well, I'll acknowledge.
And he was the one who was communicating with the Red Sox.
I have to acknowledge I don't know.
Yeah.
I
don't know either.
I don't know whether Beeston opened the process up. What I don't believe is that Paul Beeston ordered Alex Anthopoulos to do it.
No, and I think Alex, we'll find out again, but he would probably, you know, it would be more, look, your choice. You do what you want with the manager. I think you should let him go, but you do what you want. The funny thing is, you know, it's not like the Blue Jays haven't been through this before. The situation wasn't the same. The result was very positive eventually. They lost Bobby Cox. They had to go through
Jimmy Williams.
But then eventually they got to a manager who, despite your differences and a lot of people's criticisms of him, did manage the ball club to consecutive World Series. So it's not necessarily true that, you know, that because John Farrell wanted out, that it's a disaster for the ball club. The question is, you know, are they going to stumble upon the next Cito Gaston like they stumbled upon the last Cito Gaston? This is a big choice for Alex Anthopoulos. He's got to pick the right guy this time. This might be his biggest moment as the general manager.
Wait, are you saying he picked the wrong guy when he hired Farrell?
Well, he didn't work. You know, the ball club wasn't successful under him.
He made a mistake. That was a bad hire, Farrell.
I wouldn't go that far because I think it was 2 years isn't enough. But it was not a successful choice. That's what I'll say. And if he had gone to next year and they had not been successful as a team, then I would have said, yeah, they hired the wrong guy. Teams do hire the wrong guy.
Well,
we certainly know the Boston Red Sox know how to hire the wrong guy.
I hope Anthopoulos comes on here and says we basically had made the decision that John Farrell wasn't the manager, good enough. Because anything less than that, and I lose a lot of respect.
Well, I don't think he's going to sling that kind of mud. You know I'm better than that.
Well, I think he has.
He might think it.
Well, but I want him to say it. I want him to say that we made the decision based on John Farrell, not based on the pressures put by the boss.
You should email him now and tell him what you expect him to say. Here's what I want you to say.
Oh, no, I don't care what he says. I think, but we'll learn something about Alex Anthopoulos as a result of this conversation.
Well, I do think that the way this season went and the kind of things that happened and the way in which Brett Laurie played at times and the Escobar caper and the criticisms of Farrell and lots of things, you know, I think you'd agree with me the Anthopoulos honeymoon is over. He's got to now put the right people in place and win some ball games. I would say he's got to be in the conversation for at least a wild card a year from now. Or I think the pressure starts to really turn on him.
When you say a year from now, you mean in the 2013 season?
Sorry, in the 2013. So whatever.
So he's literally got, this is his offseason. If he doesn't fix this team.
I wouldn't say it would be his last year because we've had this conversation vis-a-vis Brian Burke. And I said to
right.
you, I think a guy needs 5 years. So he's now finished his third. So he's got to, in his fourth, give some sense of progress moving forward, or I think he then puts himself squarely after next season in the line for firing. If he can't, you've got to see some progress. And we heard all about the young players and everything. Turned out the young players weren't quite ready at all or quite what they thought they were.
Maybe aren't good enough.
And that card's been played. Now, that's not to say you're writing off those young players, but that card's been played. There is no young, hot guy who's going to be available. Maybe it's Travis d'Arnaud. Maybe, but he's missed a ton of time this year, right?
Yeah.
They've already played those guys. They played Gose, Hechevarria, Hutchison, who won't be back. So now the next card has to be obviously getting healthy, but also doing something with this roster, and it has to almost be trade. You might be able to tinker a little bit with free agency. He's got him, you know, so he's got some tough choices ahead of him.
Mightn't it have been better to make this move with Boston and not get Mike Avilés in return? Just take nothing.
I don't know what his contractual situation. I think they say they've got it under control for 2 years, right?
Yeah.
You know what,
but
to
he's
me?
Just, he's 31 years old.
But here's the thing.
He's a fringe major leaguer.
But you know what?
And we'll always look at him and be reminded.
Yeah, maybe.
About the Farrell thing.
First of all, he may not be here by the time spring training. They could move him and deal. The other thing, too, is.
I think that's a very valid observation.
Omar Vizquel, who was their utility guy this year, is retiring. He gives you a replacement for that if he can't start. Guy had 13 runs and said, think he had 60 ribbies. He's got a little bit of pop. He's got some experience. Mm. He doesn't have a great on-base average, but he's an experienced guy. He's got a little bit of pop. If he can't be one of your regular nine, at worst, he gives you, I would say, an improvement on your utility infield.
Well, at the end of the season,
he
couldn't play for the Boston Red Sox. And if you can't play for the Boston Red Sox, I think that tells you something.
Funny thing was, I remember being there in the spring, and Bobby Valentine was singing his praises and talking about whether he's going to get an opportunity to be the starting shortstop.
Yeah, how'd that work out? 16 past the hour, and we come back. Rob Becker joins us. Some legal issues to pass along, including Lance Armstrong stripped
to the waist. No,
of
lashes.
Not so much, but will never be acknowledged as the seven-time Tour de France winner. That stuff, when we come back and Primetime continues on The Fan and Sportsnet.
At Bodog, we're just like you. We put our sweatpants on one leg at a time. We wear our team's jersey every Sunday. We pick the over, because who wants to cheer for a low-scoring game? And, like you, we'll be there every week of the season, from the first snap of the early games to Monday night's final whistle. Play with us. Play with Bodog. Bodog.net, your trusted source for sports odds and free poker. Join Bodog today.
Set your clock radio. It's Brady and Lang in the morning. Tomorrow starting at 5:30 a.m. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Past the hour, Primetime continues on The Fan and Sportsnet. Later, Greg Zahn will join us in studio. Alex Anthopoulos, Don Banks, and Doug Smith all on the radio program. I'm McCowan, that's Cox over there. Joining us via Skype, although we're not confident that it's going to work very well today, is our friend Rob Becker, our legal analyst from the home office in New York. Hello, Becker. You look beautiful.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. Everything's going well so far.
We can hear him and see him, which is the key part.
Well, yeah. Some would say that's the good news. Some would say that's the bad news. But we will we'll trudge on. If it goes sideways, you'll pick up the phone and we'll continue the conversation by telephone. But so far, so good. News out of, I guess, Pittsburgh, that a former Steeler doctor has been indicted on charges that he illegally distributed human growth hormone, anabolics, and prescription painkillers, presumably to a significant number of Steeler football players. Interestingly, the team is not mentioned in the indictment. Again, I guess maybe they have no evidence that the team was involved or aware.
Yeah, I mean, we're not even clear that – consider this is an ex-doctor of the Steelers, right? So we're not even clear that what he's been indicted for took place during the period of time when he was a Steelers doctor. So it's a little bit early now to sort of, you know, cast aspersions on the Steelers. I mean, obviously, you know, he could have. You know, athletes like to use those substances, but we're going to have to know more about the timing. And I will say that if it really was – during the time that he was the Steelers doctor or a Steelers doctor, I would have thought that they would have mentioned that in the indictment. So I don't know. I kind of counsel holding back on this one because I just don't know if we can drag the Steelers through the mud yet.
So your suggestion then, Becker, is that the former Steelers doctor was handing out the kind of of prescriptions that football players commonly would be suspected of getting, but wasn't giving them to football players?
May not have been. That's all. May not have been. I just don't know. It's too early. Maybe he did, but I just don't think we have a lot of information to get into this too deeply yet. If they pin it to the time when he really was the doctor, then it'll be interesting to see who the witnesses are. You know, if this guy goes to trial and it really does involve that period of time, they'll have to call some Steelers as witnesses, and that would be, well, of course, they might themselves take the Fifth Amendment. Although then maybe they'll be given immunity. Who knows? But it's just, you know, it's a little bit early.
Well, it's sort of the latest in sort of a series of cases of doctors being questioned. We know the good doctor, Galea, he's been questioned. There's been a number of them. It seems as though in some ways the focus is turning towards from the athletes who are using some of these to the people who are maybe giving them to them.
Distribute him. Right, but that's not really unlike non-sports life, right? I mean, often the authorities will go after the distributor and not the user. And right. For some drugs, the user isn't doing anything illegal even. I mean, I'm not saying it's these drugs. So there's nothing weird about that, really. It makes sense. And by the way, you know, that same logic is the kind of logic that gets our friend Lance Armstrong in trouble now that we know that he's the leader of the whole drugs enterprises in the U.S. cycling world. So it is consistent to go after Lance, even if it's not consistent to go after individual Steelers.
Yeah, that whole thing, I mean, we might as well move on to Lance Armstrong since we're going there anyways.
Yep, okay.
Today, what do we have? Oakley dropped him as the final guy, stripped of all his seven tour.
There's almost nobody left.
Yeah, I don't think there is anybody left, is there? I think Oakley was the last remaining sponsor. I guess my question is, and I don't know, is there any legal avenue for now for Armstrong to fight back, or is the only one going through the arbitration system, which he clearly wants no part of?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything left. I don't. He's waived his rights. He had a right to contest it, and he didn't. And that's the kind of thing. It's one thing when you contest something and you lose and you sort of appeal to a higher authority. But if a court sees that you had a chance to contest and didn't, they're going to say, don't come bothering us when you could have, you had a path, you know, to appeal on. Right. So I really think he's done. And this is sort of this decision of the cycling union not to appeal is that's a kind of neutral judgment, is that they looked at USADA's evidence and they made a kind of neutral judgment that no, it was not something that they should appeal. And you remember, up until now, Lance has always taken the position, well, you know, USADA's out to get me, it's a witch hunt. But he never said that about the cycling union, so I don't know what more his argument's going to be. I think he's going to start to fade away, actually.
Well, before he fades away, he may be forced to give back a whack of money. A Texas insurance company wants $7.5 million from him?
Right. That's a tricky one, though. That's an interesting case, and I'm not so sure that Lance loses that case. What's going on there is he had an arbitration against them, and they said, you know, look, we think, this was several years ago, we think that you cheated and you didn't win the Tour de France fair and square, and therefore we shouldn't have had to pay, you know, insurance on bonuses that you got for winning the Tour de France, and particularly for winning the Tour de France 7 years in a row. Or actually it was six years in a row was an extra bonus. He won it seven times.
Yep.
And in the end they lost because he had not officially had the title taken away from him. He was in fact the winner, and they reached an agreement that no one could challenge the arbitrator's decision. So does that if they have an agreement that no one can challenge the arbitrator's decision, does that mean that you can't challenge it even if the facts change? Because obviously the insurance company's lawyers are saying, look, the facts are different from what they were before because now he is no longer the winner of the Tour de France as of today. So, but that's a very arguable point, whether that constitutes challenging an arbitrator's decision or not. There's also a question of whether there was any release involved. If there was a release that says, I release all claims that I know or don't know about, up until now, and often at least we'll say includes the claims you don't know about, then I think Lance is definitely going to be fine. So that insurance company better not have entered into that kind of release, because then it's really over. And if it's just a question of overturning the arbitrator's decision, challenging the arbitrator, that's an arguable point. And by the way, it'll be the same three arbitrators. So they'll know what they meant, I think, when they say, you know, there's no questioning the arbitrator's decision. So we'll just have to see.
This is not a legal question. Have either of you guys seen any estimate of Armstrong's personal wealth?
Yeah, I have, you know, and a lot of it, well, I mean, there was a lot of monies earned. And I mean, one of the questions was about the U.S. Postal Service and what monies they may have forwarded to him for his cycling. I don't know, Rob, have you?
No, I haven't seen the numbers, but I mean, from what I can tell, this is not that much. It might be a lot to you and me, but and I'm sure Lance doesn't want to pay it. But if he loses this case, I don't think it's going to make much of a difference in his life or his lifestyle.
He's a very wealthy guy.
Yeah. The suggestion, I've just been told, the suggestion is around $125 million.
There you go. Which is why, I mean, and Rob may want to jump in here, is this notion of, well, you know, it's too expensive. I can't defend myself. You know, everybody's picking on me. Goes a little dry when it comes to Lance Armstrong. He has plenty of resources should he choose to use them. Don't you agree, Rob?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure that that's what he meant when he said, I'm not going to fight this. I don't think he was talking so much about the money. I think he was talking about what he said, at least, whether you believe it or not, is, you know, it would take time away from him and his family, and the psychological challenge of battling this was too much. He just wanted to spend more time with his family. I don't think he was really focusing on the money, because people would have said the very thing you just said.
Right. I was just going to ask, do you think at any of this, and I know these are different authorities doing these different cases against athletes, is there any reason though to connect the dots in a larger sort of sense, a macro sense, between Armstrong, Marion Jones, Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens? Are these all part of, because some of these are government agencies that are prosecuting them, and some of them are quasi-government agencies. I mean, is there a larger sense that there is a concerted effort between all these organizations to pursue these athletes?
You know, I don't really think so. And I'll tell you one very good reason to say they're not together is, I was shocked when, remember, the feds were investigating Armstrong. There was this chance that he was going to be indicted by the federal government, and then they dropped it. Now, it seems to me that if they're all working together, you know, they would have availed themselves of whatever USADA had,
right,
and realized they had a pretty good case. I mean, I think, you know, granted, a criminal case is a higher standard of proof than USADA has to deal with. It's beyond a reasonable doubt. But boy, I'll tell you, with the 22 witnesses, many of them under oath, many of them who rode with him, and some of those were guys who had no aspersions cast on their character. Boy, I think they had a pretty good shot at convicting him beyond a reasonable doubt. So, and I'm still amazed by that, but I think it sort of answers your question that they're not all working together, and you know, politics comes into it, etc.
Real quickly before we go, it's true, folks. A Nevada judge has agreed to reopen the armed robbery and kidnapping case against O.J. Simpson in order to ascertain whether Simpson's representation was so bad that he didn't get a fair trial.
Is it like his offensive line wasn't good enough?
It's not unlike that, I guess. Becker, we all kind of watched with some interest that case unfold there. Is there reason to believe that lawyer was, he got his name out of a cereal box?
No, I don't think that the case really turns on whether Yale Galenter, who was the lawyer who represented him in the past, is a competent attorney. They're not really questioning how good an attorney he is. It's more about a conflict of interest. As I understand it, they're saying that there's evidence that Galanter knew about what O.J. was going to do in Nevada, and that whole confrontation with guns, etc., that he knew about it and, in a sense, authorized it beforehand. And I guess the argument is he had a conflict of interest, because if he had told O.J. to get on the stand, and apparently told O.J. not to get on the stand, and apparently O.J.'s local attorney might not have given the same advice. But apparently the argument is if O.J. had gotten on the stand, then maybe it would have come out in some way that arguably that Yale Galenter had approved this beforehand, and that would be a conflict of interest, because that would mean Yale would be more likely to tell him, don't go on the stand. Now, I'm sort of putting this together from the tea leaves here, but I think that's the argument. Then the other argument that I think is clearer is that O.J. says there was a deal that the authorities offered him for 2 to 5 years, and Galenter never told him about it. Now, if that happened, that's clearly a violation. A lawyer must always tell his client of an offer, particularly something like that, you know, a plea bargain. So if that really happened like that, then I think O.J. has a serious argument.
Yeah, the only problem with that suggestion is that the source for that is O.J. Simpson, who hasn't exactly been the most truthful guy in the world.
Right, but remember, you could find out from the government, did they offer that
sure,
or not, and I don't see why they would lie.
Well, no, except I would say to you, Rob, and I mean, what do I know, but if it's that straightforward, wouldn't somebody have asked that question already and know what the answer is? I mean, do you have to go through this whole process? I mean, isn't it automatically a mistrial?
Well, it isn't necessarily something that's found out about, because if the, let's say the government did offer that 2 to 5 years,
yeah,
they would just assume that it was passed on by the lawyer to OJ, because that's what's supposed to happen. So they're sitting there thinking it was passed on, and OJ said, no, I don't want it. And maybe OJ doesn't find out about it.
Okay, but OJ says this happened. That offer would have come from the prosecutor, right?
Right, but it would have been passed on to him by Galani.
Okay, but all right. But now, so here's what I do. Duh. I go to the prosecutor, say, did you offer 2 to 5? And if he says, yes, I did, and OJ says, I didn't hear it, mistrial.
Well, it's not a mistrial.
Or a retrial, at least.
It could have happened. In other words, Bob, that could be what you just said could be the very thing that led to the charge that's now being made, that this offer wasn't passed on to him. So maybe it went down the way you said, although not at the time, you know, since. And
yeah.
Remember, OJ has attorneys now. So his present attorneys could have gone to the authorities and said, did you make an offer of 2 to 5 years? Because my client says he was never told that back then when he had a different lawyer.
Yeah. Well, we could get into a he said, she said there, too, but... we'll watch with interest because there's nothing involving OJ that is commonplace. Mr. Becker, yeah. You look beautiful, and it all worked swimmingly, so we'll try it again. Thanks, pal. Talk to you soon.
See you.
Rob Becker, our legal analyst from New York. When we come back, Zani in studio will take you through this managerial mess on the weekend from Zon's perspective, and then Alex Anthopoulos will join us at the top of the next hour. This is Primetime on the Fan and Sportsnet.
At Bodog, we're just like you. We put our sweatpants on one leg at a time. We wear our team's jersey every Sunday. We pick the over because who wants to cheer for a low-scoring game? And like you, we'll be there every week of the season, from the first snap of the early games to Monday night's final whistle. Play with us. Play with Bodog. Bodog.net, your trusted source for sports odds and free poker. Join Bodog today.
MLB playoffs tonight starting at 7. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sixteen minutes before the hour, Primetime continues on the Fan and Sportsnet. McCown, Cox, there's our friend Greg Zahn in studio. Well, it's the story. It's not the big surprise. We've been seeing this coming. We've been talking about it for months. We spoke on this program last week and reported that there was a story out of Boston that the preliminaries had concluded. And in fact, they had, and the deal was struck and announced yesterday. John Farrell off to Boston as a manager of the Red Sox. Is this how you would have done it?
No, not anywhere close.
What would the Greg Zahn prescription have been? Well, how do you handle this whole thing?
I would have been a little bit more forceful. I would have exercised strength. I think the Blue Jays were in a position of power because they had something that Boston wanted in John Farrell. If you're willing to entertain the idea of trading your manager 2 years after you hire him, probably not the right guy for the organization. If you're even entertaining the thought, whether it's because you love the guy, he's your best friend, you want to see him happy in his dream job, as we've been hearing. If he's the guy to manage the Blue Jays going forth, then you're not even thinking about trading this guy. Okay, so now we're assuming that you are thinking about trading him, and that means he's not the right guy. You still have something that the Red Sox want. You're in a position of power. They have a limited amount of time in which to hire a manager. They probably, in my opinion, wanted to get it done before the World Series was over. So if you sit back and you wait, whether you want John Farrell to manage next year or not, you sit back and you wait. And you tell him, I want Clay Buchholz or John Lester or Daniel Bard. Or maybe let's talk about Dustin Pedroia. Let me package an Adam Lind and a
Yunel Escobar with John Farrell, and we'll take Dustin Pedroia. So short of that, see ya. I don't even want you to call me. When you're ready to talk real deal, call me on the phone. And then you sit back and you wait and you let them come to you because you have something that they want. And let's assume that you don't want John Farrell to be the manager next year and they run out of time and they get impatient and they hire, say, Brad Ausmus to be the manager of the Boston Red Sox. And you don't want John Farrell to be the manager, you fire him. Because you know what? The fact that he's been talking about it, the fact that he's told you to your face that this is his dream job means that the Blue Jays job wasn't his dream job. So fire him. Let him go. Go hire somebody else. Now, I don't know what went down in the clubhouse last year. All I can say is whoever they bring in next, he better be a strong personality. X's and O's is the easy part. It's managing personalities that's the difficult thing.
That surprised me when you say that, because having talked to him some, not nearly as much as you, I would describe John Farrell as having a strong personality, which lends opens the question, either his personality wasn't translated within the clubhouse to the players, or he couldn't do the things that he wanted to do to discipline the ball club. There's all kinds of rumors about, but he doesn't strike me as a soft personality, John Farrell. Does he strike you as a soft personality?
I the only thing I know is what I see. I don't believe in all the gas. I believe in actions. And so it's either, and I may end up owing John an apology someday when all this truth comes out, because it'll come out. At some point, you know, somebody's going to tell the truth about what really went down in the clubhouse this year. Whether or not John wanted to be a disciplinarian and wasn't allowed to be a disciplinarian, or whether he just didn't do it. Maybe it just wasn't in his nature. I mean, there's a lot of people out there who have strong personalities on the surface, but when it comes to brass tacks, taking a guy out of the lineup and making an example out of him, some people don't have the stomach for it.
Right.
What bothers me here, and this is essentially, I think, what you're saying, at least in part, is that once again, for the second time in a couple of months, the Blue Jays make a decision that I think is inherently the wrong decision.
Well, it's weak. That's what bothers you, right?
Well, you know, the Escobar situation.
Right.
You know, I look at the Escobar situation, I said, you know, the easiest thing in the world to do and what you should have done is taken the high road and said, you are never playing for this organization again.
Go home.
Go home. Get lost. Don't come back. It's not like this is a five-time Gold Glove winner. He's a decent shortstop, but he's not a five-time Gold Glove winner, and you got Hecheverria coming anyway. You could have made a statement. This is what we stand for. And they didn't. Now with Farrell, and in listening to your analysis, again, a chance to make a statement. Don't come in here and bully us. Don't play games with our people. We'll decide what we want to be and what we want to do. And again, for the second time in a couple of months, they don't make that call. They take the easy way out.
Well, like I said, it'll all come out in the wash. We'll find out who said what, who didn't do what. But from my perspective, I'm looking in at the situation, and I didn't see a fundamentally sound ball club. I saw a team who became less and less disciplined over the course of the season. I saw young players actually go back in their development. Actually, Their development was retarded by this season. So I look at the situation as an outsider and looking in and having a baseball background, and I think, okay, there was not strong leadership in that clubhouse, whether it was actually coming from the managerial side or somewhere else. There just wasn't strong leadership. Right. They didn't make any adjustment. That, regardless of the – who cares about the injuries? There were a lot of players on that team that had a chance to get better over the course of this season that did not.
Okay, let me ask, as a former player, take yourself back into the clubhouse, and you've been in a few of them. It's easy for us on the outside to say the manager is at fault for just what you talked about, the retarding of the development of the players. How much of it falls on the coaching staff?
Well, I'll put it to you this way. As a coach in the major leagues, you are not going to bite the hand that feeds you, okay? There's too much at stake as a coach in the major leagues to really step outside the line that has been established by the manager, by the general manager. You're talking about a salary. You're talking about health and medical benefits for your family. You are not going to I'll give you a prime example. When I was playing for the Marlins, first year that Jim Leland took over, and I won't name names, but I was having a conversation about strategy with a coach, on his staff. And I asked him, I said, what would you do in this situation? And it was almost like his eyes glazed over, and he says, you don't ever second guess the skipper. Only bad things happen when you second guess the skipper. And I was like, holy smokes, you really are drinking the punch. But that, but when you play the game a long time and you realize that it's a livelihood for these people, you understand that coaches are probably, they might not agree with what the manager does. They may not agree with his personality, the way he sets forth the rules or whatever. But the fact is that he's part, you're part of the staff. So you're probably going to try to be as respectful to the skipper and his decisions as you possibly can and be a good soldier and back it up. You know?
Now, but, given what you said before, it sounds like you don't assign much value to what they did get
in this trade.
You don't think he can be a replacement for Kelly Johnson at second base?
Not even close. This is a guy who swings and misses almost as much as Kelly Johnson.
Oh, yay.
Well, he's a guy who lost his job 120 games into the season.
Well, he's always been – he's a guy that is in love with swinging for power. Sounds like some other shortstop that we have.
Right.
A guy that wants to be the home run hitter. He's an okay fielder, in my opinion. He's not as good a shortstop as Yunel Escobar.
Again, and that's what I think Bob brought up.
He's 31 years old, too.
But you brought up a good point, too. Would you almost be better at that point to take – to take nothing,
yeah,
and to say, fine, you don't want to work for us, get lost. At least you're making some sort of a statement. But this
and then,
way,
and then every time that guy walks onto the field in the minds of every fan, that's the guy, that's John Farrell, reminds him of a bad situation.
He's not a bad utility infielder. At least he's got some pop.
Really?
Yeah, he's got
some
pop.
Is he an upgrade on Vizquel?
No, not fielding-wise, but he's an upgrade on a Mike McCoy.
Okay.
Man, if that's your priority at this point...
Mission accomplished.
You're screwed.
I know, but it's a right-handed power bat off the bench.
So I think there's a lot of downside to that. Thanks, Sonny.
Yeah.
I suspect this conversation will continue for some time, like the whole offseason.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Alex Anthopoulos is next. We'll get his take on it when primetime continues in a moment.